Hi there, and welcome to another episode of Horse Sense, a show for you, the thinking horse person. At Horse Sense, we give you practical, relevant, up-to-date, and even inspirational information that's really going to enrich your horsing life. If you're a first-time listener, welcome. And if you've been here before, welcome back. It's great to have you. This show is brought to you by the Equine Care Clinic, a clinic dedicated to the care of sick or injured horses when their owners aren't able to. Check out the site at equinecareclinic.com. I'm your host, Amanda Edwards, and this week I'm talking to Carol Layton about feeding the laminitic horse. And we've all had that challenge. Well, not all of us, but most of us. Carol's an endurance rider with a Bachelor of Science. She found it really hard to find credible information on how to get the best out of her horse, so she began to study for her own benefit. Fast forward to today, and Carol's now a writer, speaker, and expert on the topic of horse nutrition. Carol works with horse owners throughout Australia to help them develop feeding regimes that suit their horses' individual requirements. Had a little bit of trouble with the connection in this interview, but we got there in the end. The information's well worth a listen, so I really hope you like it. Hi, Carol, and welcome to Horse Sense. How are you today?
Oh, I'm great. Thank you. Yeah, thank you for inviting me to speak.
It's an absolute pleasure. I've been trying to talk to you for a long time because you are pretty much Australia's number one expert on all things horse nutrition, as far as I'm concerned. So,
I've read
a lot of your articles, and I've always wanted to come, and I haven't quite managed to get to one of your forums or workshops, but I will one day. So tell us, Carol, how did you get to be an equine nutrition expert?
Oh, look, I think it's a common story. Well, first of all, I've got a science degree, and I've been for many years a science and technology teacher. So I'm already thinking along that line of thought. And it was back in 2007 when I remember at the time I was being told to feed, brewer's yeast, rose hips, garlic, that sort of thing to my horses, for my horses. And I just questioned it, and every person I asked why should I feed those sorts of additives, no one could really tell me why. It was very airy-fairy, and as someone who's got a science degree, I found that quite frustrating. So I actually started looking for an equine nutrition course, and this was just for me and my horses. Now, I'm a very keen endurance rider, so I think that endurance is one of those equestrian sports that makes it even more important that we have a good understanding of how to manage our horses. After searching for an equine nutrition course, I mean, there were quite a few in the country, but what I really wanted was something that was very deep and, you know, would give me the opportunity to truly understand rather than just be told what to feed. And so after some fairly extensive searching, I found Dr. Eleanor Callan, who is a vet in America, who is really is a specialist expert in equine nutrition. And I've been learning from her ever since. And in 2008, she actually asked me to tutor the new students in her course, NRC Plus, which has been a great learning experience for myself as well. And then I think it was in 2011, I got asked to speak at the Functional Hoof Conference and also to start teaching nutrition to the students of the Australian Certified Equine Hoof Care Practitioners course in Australia. And then it's just sort of continued on. So I originally started for my own horses, but when people saw the success I was having with my own horses, they asked me if I could do the same thing for them. And it's really just grown from there.
So tell me, Carol, a bit about your horsing background. Where are we talking to you from for a start?
Okay, I'm near Gloucester in New South Wales, which is about 2 hours northwest of Newcastle. We have a bunch of Arabs here that are either in various stages of being actually in work for endurance, or they're retired.
Yeah. All the older retirees. So, how many horses do you
Retired.
have? Do you know?
We have, yeah, no, it's not that many. We've got six horses, so
Oh,
two of
that's a
them
very
are actually
respectable
my
number.
endurance horses.
Yeah,
Yeah.
okay. And you do lots of endurance riding, which looks fantastic. I do keep, I love watching. Endurance is something I've never had a real go at, and I look at it and I'm quite envious and think, I might have a crack at that one day.
Oh, you
So
should. It's absolutely so much fun and it's very social and you can do it at any level. I actually do it mainly for the social fun. I'm not trying to win or anything. I think that's what I love about endurance is that it's your own personal competition and the motto to complete is to win is so true.
yeah, well, that's really true, particularly if you're doing the big ones. It's quite incredible, some of those photos that come out. I'm a little bit in awe of some people. And I've just moved to a new property, and my neighbours are actually endurance people, so it's piqued my interest even more. So I'm just taking back to your comment about the science around nutrition. This is something in my work as at the equine care clinic. When we get sick or injured horses, I feel like nutrition is the one thing that I can do well that can really help them heal. And so I agree with you, it's been really hard to get good information and scientifically based information. And sometimes I see people feeding so many supplements that I think, how do they even know that the horse needs that if it's a perfectly healthy horse? And how much do they, like, you wouldn't treat people like that. So without knowing the dosage and the rate, but we just kind of happily mix up all this stuff. So tell me, what's in general, what's your approach, sort of philosophy to feeding?
Well, the general approach really is to look at what horses evolved on. Their digestive system is designed to be a hindgut fermenter, a trickle feeder, and the health of their hindgut has so much to do with, immune system, their behavior, their even breeding efficiency. There's a whole range of studies now that show that horses on high fiber compared to low fiber. They benefit so much by being on high fiber, and it's almost like, do we really need a study for that? Yet, if you have a look at the Australian feed industry, you'll see that so many of the feeds are very, very much based on a muesli mix of cereal grains, or they're very heavily based on brands like rice bran, for example, which is very high starch. So, the higher the grain in the diet, and the higher the brands, for example, the Pollard, the Milrun, those sorts of feeds, then obviously it's going to be a much, much lower in fibre. And a small amount's no big deal in the scheme of the whole diet. But if you really want to make your horse as healthy as possible, and nutrition is one thing we can control. I mean, there's many things that we can't control when it comes to managing our horses, but nutrition is one we can. And so the quality feeds are the ones that are very, very high in fiber. And you can tell by simply looking at the ingredient list because, unfortunately, the marketing of feeds means that I know of many feeds that say they're high fiber, but when you look at the ingredient list and the percentage of fiber, that's not actually the case.
Yeah, exactly. And okay, so in terms of when you say fiber, we're talking hay and chaff, essentially, aren't we?
If we go to the basics, then the best grass, oh, sorry, the best feed of all is actually grass. And obviously, there are some exceptions to the rule, like where we're talking about insulin resistant horses, and we just put that aside for the moment. Or there are strains of certain species of grasses that can have endotoxins to consider. But if we just that aside for the moment, for the vast majority of situations that horses are in, the absolute number one feed for horses is grass. because it is the only feed that has the breadth, the range of nutrients that horses need. And anything in a bucket or a shiny, you know, container from the saddlery, the stock feed supplier, anything in a bag cannot, as in a feed, cannot beat grass. And that's why I always have a bit of a dry chuckle when I read about complete feeds, because there's no such thing. It can't possibly be. There are nutrients in grass that simply don't survive the processing, the harvesting, the curing when it in feeds. And so they may be that breadth of nutrients in grass plant, that we're talking about live plant material, may not always be in high enough quantities to be optimal for horses, but there is nothing manufactured that can beat it. So I often visualize an advertisement in a magazine or a flyer, if you can, or a website, if you can imagine, where it says rich in antioxidants, rich in the nutrients, the vitamins, this, that, and everything else. And then instead of a picture of a bucket of some mineral vitamin product or a bagged feed, just imagine a picture of grass, and that would fit more appropriately. But you won't see that, and I think that's the power of marketing. Grass is number one. And if grass is not enough to support the horse, let's say, especially if your horse is in work, or your grass doesn't have perhaps high enough energy value, or whatever it might be the case,
well,
then
we
the
don't
next
have any grass.
Chaff or hay. Or, yeah, if you don't have grass at all, which is quite – I've just come back from Western Australia actually delivering seminars there, and that's very appropriate over there. They've got so many horses just on sand. Grass is number one. Number two then is chaff or hay, which is obviously harvested grass, and then chaff being cut up hay. And then after that, when that's not enough, you then go and choose a high-fiber fermentable feed. And that can be based on beet pulp, it could be based on lupin hulls, and it could be based on soybean hulls. And then after that, if your horse, for example, is likely to hit fatigue doing whatever work you're asking your horse to do, and at that point, after all those other feeds, then you start looking at a grain. And, of course, the safest and most palatable grain of all is oats.
Yep. Which is what every – like my mum, that's all we ever fed our horses when I was growing up. Mum used to just – we'd have heaps of hay, heaps of chaff, and we were on small lots, so there wasn't a lot of grass. But she would graze them wherever we could, and then we'd put in some oats, even on all the horses, the race horses, everything, the ex-races we had. And they didn't get hot.
There's this mentality that if you feed oats, your horses are going to go, you know, flip their lid, they're going to go fizzy. And for a small minority, it's quite possible that they've got a feed intolerance to oats. Now, horses can have a feed intolerance to any feed ingredient. So full-fat soybean meal is a bit of a culprit for that. But it could also be specific species of grass that can cause a feed intolerance or allergy, an actual allergy. So the thing is that if it doesn't, like oats don't agree, sure, don't feed oats. We've always got lots of choices. But for the vast majority of horses, a moderate amount of oats is a very wise choice. And it saddens me that there are stock feed suppliers now that don't even sell oats. You'll find them at the back of the shed. They're usually in a secondhand bag or in a Hessian sack, and they're not promoted because they're not being value added. They're straight from the farmer, and they are a seed which has the nutrients locked in. And certainly if your horse has got poor dentition, then you may choose to put them in the blender or buy them cracked or rolled or something like that. But a lot of horses, just the whole oats is brilliant. And they have the lowest glycemic index response compared to the other grains. Barley and corn are associated more with gut disturbances. That's documented. Not that that means your horse would have a gut disturbance by eating barley, but it's a higher probability.
Okay, so that's a really good myth to dispel, because I think oats have been much maligned, and a lot of us that are getting older now know it's, what worries me is that the younger people growing up, all they know is the packaged feeds. They don't know anything else. So I think this is a really important discussion to have. And the topic that we were actually going to drift into today was laminitis, because I want to get you back in another time and talk about tie up, because I find that tying up, because I find that really fascinating, and I know that people have got no idea. So so anyway, back to laminitis. Laminitis is also probably the most common thing we all have to deal with, and the most probably poorly managed, not through a want of trying, but just people just don't know what to do and nothing seems to be working. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, first of all, laminitis is defined as inflammation of the lamina, which are in the hoof, the finger-like projections that lock together. So it's a bit like Velcro. So that unzipping, that undoing of the connection between the sensitive and the insensitive lamina in the hooves are what cause rotation or sinking to occur of the pedal bone, the dropping down of the bone column inside the hoof capsule. I mean, it's a catastrophic event, but most of the laminitis that we would consider dietary, because there are other causes that have got nothing to do with dietary, but if we just focus today on dietary laminitis, the biggest cause of laminitis is chronic laminitis, what we call long-term laminitis from insulin resistance. The other type is your rich overload of carbohydrate, or overload of rich carbohydrate into the hindgut, which is an acute laminitis. So very much, you know, the horse breaking into the grain bin and gorging, or breaking into that paddock of ryegrass that was richly fertilized and meant to be harvested for cattle, then quite possibly a horse can have that catastrophic event. But the one that is the most common that causes that separation in the hooves, when people talk about the hooves being a little bit sore, they're a bit foot sore, for example, and you see the lamina rings, or you see that like the hoof's not as good as it could be, there might be a cresty neck, for example. Insulin resistance is the most common, and it's literally like diabetes 2 in people, where it's insulin being produced, and insulin's all about moving nutrients into cells from the bloodstream. But the problem is that the horse is continually producing insulin, and it's like there's no one listening, and that insulin levels, when they get too high, will trigger a series of events which causes laminitis. So it can be, I think what people often are not sure of is that laminitis, or insulin resistance, I should say, it's very much on a spectrum. You can have the extreme insulin resistant horse that cannot eat a blade of grass, which makes it difficult when you've got paddocks of grass. And then there's the mildly insulin resistant horse, which can tolerate some grass, but you've got to manage the horse.
Which is probably more common.
Yeah, I think, yeah, absolutely. It's definitely more common. And especially here, it's not like in California and places like that where they have dry lots and don't ever have grass and they just get hold of low sugar starch hay. But here on pasture, it's very much based on whether the horse is overweight. Often being overweight will increase the insulin resistance, which means decreases the insulin sensitivity, or the horse is not getting enough movement, enough exercise, because exercise can be such a huge trigger in terms of the metabolism and making the horse more insulin sensitive. So it's not uncommon to hear of horses that have been retired from many years of being worked, and then the owner discovering for the first time that this horse actually needs to have low sugar starch feed, because the horse gets laminitic. It's the absence of all that exercise. And the other thing to know is that insulin resistance, it's different to diabetes 2 in people, in that it's not common. It's, in fact, it would be an extreme thing to find high glucose levels. So some of the remedies that work in people are not really applicable to horses, very limited in horses, you know, because there are ways that in people who have diabetes too to lower the glucose levels. But in horses, they're not high to start with. So it's not quite the same.
No, and that's an important fact to understand too. The it gives us a bit of relevance to talk about it in terms of, because people have a bit more of an understanding of what diabetes is, but the mechanisms are a little bit different in terms of the insulin uptake and all that sort of stuff. So
in a way, it's not a disease. It's not necessarily even a negative disorder. It's actually an evolutionary advantage. This is what enabled horses to survive periods of being on pasture, for example, or grass plant material that was of a much lower value than what our pasture improved grass species are now. And so in periods of low nutrient intake, and maybe they had to move around a lot to get what they needed to satisfy their energy requirements, being an insulin-resistant horse, which usually means a good doer, was actually a good thing. This was a feature. And, of course, it's not because we have horses on these pasture-improved grasses and we confine them, we don't, you know, they're not walking 3 days to get to water like the Brumbies have been tracked in the central Australia and so forth. They're not getting the movement that a horse that was wild would get necessarily. But on the other hand, I do want to say that that the Brumbies in Central Australia, Chris Pollock, Brian Hampson of University of Queensland and their team, did find evidence of past laminitic episodes in those hooves, which makes sense because when the rains come at the end of all those long, when the rains come, years of drought, and then it's just kaboom, you know, you've got this rich feed coming up everywhere and they can just gorge themselves on it. That it's not the gorging so much, but it, like the lack of movement, more the lack of movement, because they're eating, it's there right in front of them. And then combine that with the high carbohydrate level, particularly sugar and starch, then it makes sense that quite possibly these horses have, some of them would be insulin resistant as well. And that same thing's been found in Mustangs in America, because there was a case where they broke through a fence and got into a protected area that they hadn't been able to get into, where it was lots of grass, long grass, that sort of thing. And a herd of them ate and ate and ate, and then people found them later. They'd all died from laminitis. Yeah,
wow.
So the thing is there's this assumption that if the horse is a wild horse or, you know, it's not possible, and that's not correct. And there's an assumption that it's a domesticated horse issue, and it is to the degree that we have exacerbated it. We are providing the conditions, the environment for this to become a negative rather than an advantage for horses. So the richer the pasture is not really the best thing for horses. If we can, we want to get the dairy country, for example.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that you're quite right. It's the feed, you know, we've made paddocks for cows who have more than one stomach and a lot more gut to, you know, process the food and the sugars. And we're putting our horses on it who have a completely different digestive system. So it's very important to understand that. So I'm glad you made that point. So going back to our fat little laminitic pony in the paddock, how are people best to deal with that?
Well, this is the tricky part. First of all, you need a vet to diagnose, but the sort of symptoms that are typical of a horse with, you know, I mean, I'm not talking about full-on laminitis. You're talking about horses that are showing separation and discomfort. Okay, easy weight gain is one of the symptoms. So I'm going to go through the symptoms. And an insulin resistant horse may not have all of these, may only have some. And crusty neck, one of the features is unusual fat deposits on the body. So a fatty sheath is a bit of a classic. The crusty neck is an obvious one. Base of the tail, it could be base of the neck behind the shoulder. It could be puffiness, which is the fat in the hollows above the eyes. There's advanced symptoms like increased thirst and urination. That's a possibility. And then loss of body condition, especially muscle, low energy levels. And another one is fairly not surprising, is a ravenous appetite as a response to the poor movement of glucose into cells. So even though the horse is getting high levels of sugar and starch, it still can show signs of a ravenous appetite due to low glucose levels in the cells. Isn't that interesting?
That's incredibly interesting. Yeah, actually, it makes sense now that you say it, but I'd never thought about that, nor have I, come across that. That's great.
Yeah, so if your horse is showing any of those signs, and it could be a horse that is looking absolutely fine, is not overweight. I mean, there's underweight horses that are insulin resistant. It's all quite complex. But the issue is, the bottom line is that there is simply too much sugar and starch in the diet causing that insulin to go high. And so, I mean, it was really helpful, I guess, when that study was done, when Chris Pollitt and his team at the University of Queensland showed by artificially raising the levels of insulin, it induced laminitis.
Yes, I did read about those. So I read that a while ago, actually. So that does help you understand that it is almost, although it's complex, it's kind of as simple as that too. Like if we've got a high sugar and we've got more insulin, we're going to get a laminitic horse. And if they're predisposed through all of those other the insulin resistance, they're more likely to get it. And typically, I'm imagining actually a little pony that I recently got to look after, Aggie. She's all of those things, those little pockets of funny fat deposits, and not overweight though. She's a nice little pony. So yeah, okay. So if you think about that sort of pony, what other symptoms? You've got your fatty deposits.
Oh, another one, which is leptin resistance. Often horses and ponies will display a ravenous appetite to the point that they'll eat and eat and eat and never stop. They don't seem to stop. They're vacuum cleaners. And people talk about how they just won't stop eating, and it's really hard to manage their weight. And a lot of people are aware that a horse being overweight for all sorts of reasons is a bad thing. Like, we really shouldn't have any fat horses at all. But the issue is that those horses need to have their feed rationed, and either through a grazing muzzle, for example, or slow feeders with the hay, or just, yeah, it's quite difficult to manage those sorts of horses. But what's going on there is that an insulin resistant horse can often be, but not always, be leptin resistant. And leptin is a hormone that tells us when we've had it sufficient to eat. Like, that's enough. I'm now going to have a snooze for 3 hours. But these guys don't have that at all. And being so, they've leptin, but again, no one's listening.
Yeah, so actually, Pauline Naughty talked about that in the Cushing's interview, which was really interesting. I think I've actually got leptin resistance myself because I never know when to
Well,
stop.
a lot of people do. It's actually quite funny because there were people who tried to develop a product, to help with the obesity epidemic, by selling leptin. But the problem is, of course, it's leptin resistance. It's not that there's not enough leptin. Adding more leptin is not going to change anything.
Because it's just not being absorbed.
Yeah, Pauline would have mentioned that because insulin resistance is actually a symptom, one of the symptoms of Cushing's.
That's right. Okay, so moving on from the symptoms, let's have a think about how do you diagnose this properly?
Well, there are tests that can be done. You can ask your vet to do a blood test for glucose level and insulin levels. The horse will be fasted. And when we say fasted, ideally, that doesn't mean zero food because stress can actually increase the insulin levels and distort the results. So, what would be better would be the horse that's just on low sugar and starch hay, for example, and keeping conditions as normal as possible, not locking a horse up that's never locked up. You know, that it can be interesting management, but trying to keep them as calm and happy as possible and still eating, but not eating high sugar starch feeds.
Yeah, so not just after they've had their muesli.
Yeah, not after they've just had cereal grains or apples or carrots or anything like that. And so the vet will take those bloods, and you can even in Australia get leptin tested as well. There's some absolutely excellent information about testing on a website called the Equine Cushing's Insulin Resistant Horse.org website. So it's www. ECIRhorse.org.
So I've got links to that on the Cushing's podcast on my webpage, so that, and I'll put links on yours attached to yours as well, so that people can go across and click on that. So yeah, great, fantastic.
Yeah, excellent information. There's also a calculator that people can type in the results from the vet test. But look, seriously, if your horse has got fat pads, is foot sore, is showing any of those symptoms, it's probably ideal to feed as if insulin resistant, even if you have not had, because any horse will benefit from a low sugar starch diet. And the reason for that is because fiber is more than just filler. If we go back to the conversation we had earlier, high soluble fermentable fiber, as in beet pulp, as in soybean hulls, as in lupin hulls, and hulls means the seed coat, not the seed itself. The beautiful thing about that is that the microbes will break, or sorry, ferment that fiber, and the products of that fermentation is actually energy. And all the nutrients. They also manufacture B vitamins. Like the best thing to have is the healthiest hindgut in a horse. And feeding a diet that is high in fat, for example, is not going to help at all. In fact, it will. Studies show that it actually causes compromised hindgut function.
So that's interesting. So in terms of like people will often add oil to the feeds, what do you say to that?
Well, I would say please stop because, pretty please, because it's interesting. Rice bran oil has been used by some researchers to trigger laminitis. Like the Equine Cushing's Insulin Resistance Group, so that website leads to a Yahoo group, though it's just transferred over to that IO Groups now. So the address will have changed, but it'll be updated on the website. The advice is to not feed any feed, no ingredient under sorry, over 4% in fat oil. And that is really good advice because there is no study, there's no research that shows that high fat is not going to trigger laminitis. We're just trying to be conservative here. So we do know that fat can be used to induce laminitis, but the question is levels. Like if we look at the natural diet of a horse, it would be around that 4% fat and lower.
Yep.
And hay, of course, is low in fat. And that leads us to the next thing. There is one exception to that rule, and the exception is omega-3 fatty acids. You see, grass is a rich source of omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids. Most people have heard of omega-3s and how good they are for us. Omega-3s are plentiful, abundant in grass, which is, I found, amazing when I first learned this. So omega-3 fatty acids, the big deal about them is that they're associated with the anti-inflammatory pathway of the immune system, and omega-6 are the inflammatory part of the immune system. I mean, we're simplifying things here, but if we can remember that omega-3 is the good guys in a way, you need both. The horses need both. So if we injure a knee and we get a swollen knee to immobilize our knee, that's important. But what we're trying to avoid is an over-the-top, inflammatory response, whether it's to an allergy or to an injury and so forth. So with grass, if you think about that, the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6 is 4 to 1, can be as high as 20 to 1. So knowing that, when you look at the products on the market that talk about being balanced for omegas, you can have another chuckle because often they're the other way around.
Yeah,
Like they've got it
exactly.
wrong. If we like, there is no study that says what the requirements are for omegas in horses. It doesn't exist. So the next best thing is that we can actually have a look at their natural diet, which is grass plant material, living plant material. And looking at that, we know that it is at least 4 to 1. Now, fortunately, if you're in a situation where you've got to feed your horse hay and you've got to feed out of a bag, because everything in a bag and in hay is very low or zero in omega-3s. Unfortunately, they're quite heat sensitive. They're not completely, fragile, but they don't survive very well the harvesting of grass into hay and chaff. And in bagged feeds, you can pretty much write them off. They don't last, they oxidize. So the thing is that if your horse is on hay and bagged feeds, your horse is therefore getting a lot less pasture. And from that point of view, we find that roughly around 100 grams of linseeds, flax seeds, or chia seeds, maybe a little bit more chia because there's less omega-3s. The ratio is a bit under in the chia compared to linseed when I look at analyses. 100 grams, or you could feed roughly 40 mil of linseed oil, and obviously not from the furniture shop.
I was just going to say, I just recently saw someone saying that they'd got their linseed oil and they showed a picture, and I was like, oh God, don't do that. Not that
Oh
one.
yeah, toxic. No, I'm
Yeah.
trying to remember what they add, whether it's terps or something. Anyway, it's on my website. I have a page called Linseeds, or Linseed Is It Safe? And the thing is that they have additives to the linseed oil in furniture shops. You do not. It's not feed grade. It's do not feed. But if you buy it from, say, a health food shop, I mean, it's better if it's refrigerated. There's a company in Queensland that's also making a stabilized linseed oil product, which is great because we haven't had much choice. So that's a possibility as well. But that's it. So if you're feeding like I used to, like I got told that I should feed a cup of vegetable oil to my horses, and I always thought, gee, that's weird. Why would I do that? But I'll do it because everyone else is. Isn't
Okay.
that the way?
That's what I did, the same thing. I've been there.
Yeah, I'll buy. I used to buy canola oil or just plain vegetable oil, whatever. It could be olive oil. It could be any of those oils, rice bran oil. It's fairly pointless in my opinion because if you think about it, there is either zero or next to no omega-3s. Canola is a little bit higher, but it's still the wrong ratio. It's pointless. We're just adding more omega-6 each time. And if your whole point, if the goal is to raise the omega-3s, then it's really only linseeds and chia that can do it.
Okay, good. Well, that's good to clear that up. Okay, so now we're feeding our, so what are we feeding our little laminitic horse? So slow feeder, if you've got no grass, or if you've got grass, what do you do?
Okay, ideally, and this is what I'm going to talk about now, the ideal. The ideal would be to locate, and I know in some parts of Australia, in fact, a lot of parts of Australia, it's not so easy, but the ideal would be to locate low sugar and starch, grass hay, could be Rhodes grass hay, that is the best quality you can find. And this is where people have, thought that what you need to find is that crappy hay that's quite poor, stemmy, must be low in sugar and starch, and true, but it's low in everything. And so those horses are going to be very nutrient deficient. So what we're after, like what I'm all about, is let's feed them as optimally as possible. Like horses didn't have to survive long to reproduce, but for our horses, our beloved horses, I'd like to feed them the best they possibly can get and be optimal for the nutrients, nothing deficient, nothing in excess, and the ratios that are, when I talk about mineral ratios, that no secondary deficiencies occurring from competition. So the thing is that what we're after is the best quality hay you can get, but that is low in sugar and starch, and that would be the first one. And then on top of that, you would need a carrier for the minerals and the salt, vitamin E and selenium, and that would come from a feed that is very high in fiber and low in sugar and starch. And there are some examples, and that would be, for example, Speedy Beet, Ultra Beet, High Gain Micro Beet. Then there's Pride's Easy Fiber, which is based on lupin hulls. There's High Gain Zero, and the feeds that I would not recommend, like, for example, High Gain don't recommend Fiber Essentials, which is a combination of soybean hulls, beet pulp, and lupin hulls. They themselves on their website don't recommend it for laminitic prone horses for some reason. And anything that is above 4% in fat, I would not touch.
So would that be, what about your soy foods? So
Enegreen Maxi Soy. I left that one out. Enegreen Maxi Soy is excellent.
Right. Okay, good. Yep. Okay. So that's the sort of range we can stick with.
Yeah. And so on top of that would be linseeds, because obviously your horse is not getting much green alive grass, and so therefore will be very omega-3 deficient. And what you need for your horse, of course, if being laminitic, you want your horse not to be in a very inflammatory biased part of the immune system. You want the other way.
Yeah. No, that's perfect.
And of course, on top of that would be a quality vitamin mineral mix. And I have one called Laminitis Rescue, which I've developed because I saw a real gap in the market, in the sense that there wasn't anything available that really is focused on laminitic horses and what really helps them. But ideally, the number one ideal is actually to get the hay tested and then have the hay balanced, so that we know what is missing and needs supplementing, what's low, and then what's high. So, for example, if I can use an example, copper and zinc, the optimal ratio for copper to zinc is actually 1:3. Most nutritionists will agree on that. So that means that if your zinc levels are very high, it will actually outcompete the copper and cause that secondary copper deficiency, even if you had sufficient copper in the diet. And the same goes for calcium-phosphorus ratio. There's some agreement that the calcium-magnesium ratio also needs monitoring. So ideally, it would be to get the diet balanced by a nutritionist like myself or someone else, or enroll in NRC Plus with Dr. Kellen and learn how to do it yourself. But the hay would need to be tested. You cannot tell how high the sugar is in hay without testing in a lab. And there are some people who incorrectly believe, I'm not sure where they're getting this from because there's not a shred of science for it, but they actually do believe that the hay, you can tell how much sugar's in the hay by the, when you soak the hay in water, by looking at the colour of the water.
Yes, that always makes me laugh. I do, and I've heard it, and I'm like, I'm really sorry to disappoint you folks. It's actually dirt and tannins and all those other things. But the interesting thing about what people believe is, and this is why I do this show, is I just want to get good information out there that's based on something, because Dr. Facebook and Dr. Google get a pretty good run out of it, and I think we need a voice out there that's saying something
Oh,
different.
look, it's very challenging and can be very frustrating, and it's why I embarked on years of equine nutrition studies, which I find absolutely fascinating. I can never stop. But the thing is that there are websites that people are reading now that are a mixture of excellent information with appalling information, sometimes bordering on dangerous information. And that appalling information has not got a shred of science to support it. It's not like there's a consensus, but often because it's a quick fix, people will go, oh, wow, that's great. I'm going to go for that. And I could, you know, we could do another talk just on that.
Maybe I will do a talk on that one day, because it's very, very interesting. And I think you've hit the nail on the head. It's got to be something people can find doable. And so that's why when I'm talking to people like you, it's trying to break down what is it the average horse owner at home who's trying to make sense of all of this avalanche of information, like it, particularly if it comes from the voice of somebody who is seen to be an authority, so a vet or somebody in that nature, then it can be, how does the average person know that? Like, it's really hard for people. So, yeah,
and
I do think that.
What makes it even harder is that vets, who I have a very, very high regard and respect for, because they're expected to know everything about every animal.
Everything,
which is impossible. look, so many vets have told me that they had next to no nutritional, equine nutrition tuition in their degrees. And so what information they're exposed to is often what they get from feed companies and supplement companies, which is basically more marketing.
Yeah, and I think people need to understand that it's a bit like your general practitioner. You've got some, they'll have areas of expertise, and it's about not making a judgment on that. Like our equine vets are excellent in Australia. I think they do an awesome job, and they have the best training in the world. You know, there's no doubt about it. We have great vets, but it's understanding what they're up against. they can't. None of us can know everything. So it's about finding the information that aligns with the best research that we've got, because there's not a lot of that either in equine. So it's getting more and more, but yeah.
Well, quite a few vets actually refer clients to me, and I, you know, present to vets, as you know, vets being part of a general audience, for example, or at conferences. And so that's very satisfying, because it means that they feel more confident being able to advise their clients as well.
Yeah, I'm sort of doing the same sort of thing with wound care. It's getting an increasing look at, so because it's another area that's not very well understood by very many people in the equine industry. So, anywho, so we're back to our little Aggie, our little little laminitic pony. We've now got her on slow feeding hay or low, you know, low sugar grasses, natural grasses if we can. And obviously exercise would be another focus of that, yeah?
Yeah, and I just want to say about the native grass species that often they are lower in sugar and starch. Notice I keep talking about sugar and starch. I've not once said NSC, non-structural
yes.
carbohydrates. And this is another thing that drives us slightly nuts, is that non-structural carbohydrates is an outdated term, even though some researchers are still using it. I was at a no laminitis conference late last year in America, in Texas, and we had a researcher from the UK who's at the coalface of the research, who's, you know, running a research establishment. And he was talking NSC, and we asked him, why do you keep saying NSC when it's well established that what causes the insulin to rise is sugar and starch? It's not NSC as being the best term. Non-structural carbohydrates includes, I guess this is going to get technical, but non-structural carbohydrates is a plant botany term, and it includes water-soluble carbohydrates, plus starch. But the water-soluble carbohydrates includes fructans. And fructans are a bit of a, there was a lot of talk about fructans and laminitic horses, because at the time it was suspected that fructans caused insulin to rise. It doesn't. And there's a number of studies now that clearly show that fructans do not. But fructans are part of that rich carbohydrate overload model. So the gorging on the oats and the grain and into a ryegrass paddock, that sort of thing. And when I say ryegrass, I'll say very rich ryegrass, not just your standard, perhaps, ryegrass. So the fructan does not cause an insulin rise. So when we're talking insulin resistance, we're not worried about the fructans. We can be worried about them in terms of overload, but it would be an very unusual, would have to be extremely, like super exceptional to have a horse just on fructans to get the rich carbohydrate overload. It's usually the sugar and starch that is the issue. So that's why I keep saying sugar and starch. And the guideline for that is that every ingredient in the whole diet, that should be 10% or under. And the only way to find that out is to test. And testing can be actually very economical. It's quite cheap to
I
do.
actually have a I've got a link to that on my website too, so you can send it over. Pauline gave us that from the ER, so
Excellent.
EIRCG as well. So
Excellent.
that's I've got
So,
that link there. Yep. So
Equi
testing,
Analytical
hey?
Lab.
Yeah.
Yeah, because unfortunately the labs in Australia essentially can't do it, or if there is one, it's going to be extremely expensive. There is one lab in Australia that is testing called Feed Central, but then they'd send the sample to Equi Analytical.
Yep. So it's no point. You may as well just send it direct, and it's only like about $80 or something. So it's not huge. Okay. So we've got our little horse there because we'll have to sort of move through. What, in short, are the sort of next steps that you want to be really covering off as well?
Oh, exercise, which you mentioned earlier, and I talked about how exercise actually can make a horse insulin sensitive. It's just huge, actually, the role exercise covers. So the thing is that even if you just take your horse for a walk, taking your dog for a walk, anything you can do, as long as the horse is comfortable, of course. We're not talking about in the stage where the horse is in pain. But anything you can do to get your horse moving, whether it's a laneway system, also known as paddock paradise, if that works for you, anything at all to get them moving is ideal. And I know on the Equine Cushing's insulin resistance group, there are many, many horses that were in a lot of danger and laminitic that are now doing pony club, they're doing show jumping, they're doing endurance, they're doing all sorts of things, trail riding, because they're being well managed. So the quality of life is so much improved just by understanding how to feed them and get them moving.
So I think that there was a couple of things before we finish up, just because it's what I come across. People still wanting to lock up the pony or lock up the horse. So can you tell me about? I mean, I know what this does to a horse's metabolic system, but tell the listeners, like, what does this do when you're doing that?
Okay. Yeah, it's a double whammy actually, because you've got the lack of movement. All right, so that's number one. But number two, unfortunately, locking up a horse or pony like that it can be actually quite dangerous. You can kill a pony doing this. It's by locking up the horse and well, putting the horse into starvation, essentially, like rationing a feed so much that the horse is not getting enough food, it tricks the body into thinking that it's being starved. And yeah, and we talk about glycogen sparing. Like it's a really bad way to do things. So it does that fit with what your understanding is?
Yeah, so and the hyperlipidemic reaction to
Yeah,
that. So
mobilization
just
of the triglycerides, yeah.
so then the liver gets you end up with multi-system organ failure, which sometimes, particularly in the smaller ponies, like I've known a couple of ponies that have died as a result, which is so sad and so preventable, that you just sort of, and the poor owners are devastated because they had no idea and someone told them that that was the way to do it. So it was just horrible. But yeah, so I just want to caution, people about that, and it just really causes a whole complete meltdown of the system. So
And
yeah.
there's another caution I'd like to add to the pile, and that is there's a opinion, because there's no science behind it. There's a belief out there being promoted that if you feed enough magnesium, your horses will never have laminitis. Have you
Yeah,
heard
that's
of
not.
this one?
Yeah, I have actually. I'd forgotten about that one. Go
And I
ahead.
do not hide from this, and
Yeah,
I'm
oh
I.
no.
Surprise me, as in I know the horse directly, and it would not surprise me if there is a large number of horses that have been killed with this. That if you feed copious quantities, like quite large quantities of magnesium, then your horse will never get laminitis. And if people could just have a think about the logic of that, if we understand that insulin resistance is caused by the rise in insulin. What causes insulin to rise is sugar and starch, starch being chains of glucose, but in a storage form. Then feeding lots and lots of magnesium is not going to make any difference at all to that issue with the sugar and the starch. Magnesium has an important role to play. It can help with moving that stubborn, cresty neck and so forth. I know we haven't got time to talk about magnesium in detail, but I just would like people to think about that, because it's just no, there is no support for it, and that is just dangerous. I mean, there are horses dying from that advice. So a little bit of magnesium can be very beneficial, especially if the calcium level in the intake is very, very high. But essentially, you should only be supplementing a small amount of magnesium. That I don't know of any nutritionist that supports the idea that more is better. And the other thing is another myth that's out there, that if you are to supplement magnesium, that magnesium oxide is poorly available in horses. And this is where people's lack of understanding can be exploited, because those studies that they use to say that magnesium oxide is a poor mineral source in horses is based on studies in people. And a lot of us know that stomach in horses is nothing like the stomach of people. Like, there's a non-glandular part in the stomach that horses will secrete hydrochloric acid continuously, whether there's food in there or not. Whereas in people, it's different. In people, apparently, it's very poor availability, which makes sense. I wouldn't want to eat it. But in a high-up fermenter, where the magnesium is going to be absorbed all the way along the intestine, it's actually got a very high, reported to be as high as 70% by availability. So it's actually a recommended supplement for horses. And what I find even more interesting is that studies show that that the magnesium in a supplement like magnesium oxide can be even more available than, say, in grass. So that's another thing altogether. Just people assume a lot of things about, oh, I don't want to feed my horses chemicals, but everything is a chemical. We wouldn't survive without chemicals. And there are good chemicals and there are bad chemicals, and there are the gray shades in between. But a lot of people are feeding magnesium chloride, which probably is fine, but there is at this stage no study that has been done to show how bioavailable magnesium chloride is in horses. And you've got to be really careful with it, because if you use a lot of it, if you don't dilute it enough, it can be very caustic. Apparently, it's quite useful. I've heard that you can have a bath in it, with magnesium chloride dissolved in the water. Apparently, that's quite good. I'm not Sure.
It's very good for your muscles, apparently.
Well, yeah,
And
magnesium is.
magnesium, it's actually very, magnesium's well absorbed by humans in the skin. So that's probably where that comes from.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that work for people that are then extrapolated to
Straight
horses, and
across, and it's not the
sometimes you
same.
can't. Yeah.
You can't take a direct lift. That's the thing. We're similar, but not that
No.
similar.
No. So if you are supplementing magnesium chloride, as I said, it's probably fine. It's very low source, like it's not very high in magnesium chloride. But it may well be quite good in rats, you know, and it's interesting to bring up rats only because there has been a study done where they compared magnesium sources, and it was interesting to find that magnesium oxide and magnesium chloride were pretty much the same for rats in terms of bioavailability. But in horses, there is no study yet that shows whether magnesium chloride is useful. And I don't have a problem with people using it because I suspect that it will show that it's fine. I can't see any reason why not, but we don't
Well,
know
you'd
how
think that
much.
the chloride and the oxide bit would just be absorbed anyway, so you'd end up with the magnesium left. But anyhow, that's a kind of
Well,
yeah, so
it's an example,
interesting.
actually. I think it's a useful example to show how much poor information is out there because it's on websites everywhere. It's being taught to people. And what if that happens, that means that they're ignoring the science that exists.
Yeah, which is a bit of a shame, really. So we get it out there one way or another, Carol.
Oh, I think it's,
So
you know, people to know.
yeah, absolutely, I agree. So if in the wrapping up, what would be the key tips you would leave for horse owners in managing their laminitic prone horse or
I
pony?
really think that first of all, talk to your vet and get some advice. Hopefully, your vet is up to date with the latest research in laminitic horses and the causes, for example, because it may not be insulin resistant. There may be something else going on. But once you have talked to your vet, I think the next step would be to find a nutritionist like myself who understands the research. And I'll say that because, you know, there are people out there claiming to know this, but they don't. You know, for example, one of the myths also is to supplement chromium in horses because it's been shown to have benefits in people with diabetes too.
Oh, okay. I haven't heard that one, but yeah. Okay. Yep.
Yeah, no,
So.
it's. There have been studies in people that it has decreased insulin levels and improved glucose dispersal, but the studies in horses, what it's shown is that it's only really been helpful in terms of glucose regulation, and that's a good thing. But again, going back to the glucose, horses don't, as a rule, have high glucose levels, so that's one thing. And the other thing is that chromium is generally already abundant in the natural diet. So in hay, in grass, grown on acidic to neutral soils, you would expect plenty of chromium.
Yeah,
And
it's
again,
never
more is
come
not
up as an
better.
issue for any of that I've tested. So, okay, so number three.
Well, essentially, it's get some expert help, but also do go to that equine Cushing's and insulin resistant website because there is a treasure trove of information there backed by science. Dr. Kellen is part of that group, and you can also study equine nutrition. Dr. Kellen offers a little course, 10-week course in insulin resistant horses that is very affordable. It's online and that's on her website, drkellen.com.
Cool. That's a good one. Okay, so that's fantastic, Carol. I have learnt heaps sitting here talking to you. So I know that our listeners are going to get so much out of it, and we're now like the reach is getting bigger and bigger. I recently got contacted by Kanya in Sweden. So hello to Kanya out there. I was quite chuffed. So we're getting the message out there, and I really thank you for your time today, and I really would love to have you back again to talk more, because it's just been I know these things are what people really struggle with on a day-to-day. So thanks so much,
Excellent.
Carol. Have a
Thank you for
great
having
day,
me.
won't you? Oh, it's been a
Yeah,
pleasure, an
too.
absolute pleasure. Bye.
Bye.
Interesting info, right? My top three takeaways from today are: number one, don't believe everything you see on Facebook or read on Google. Try to sort the wheat from the chaff, so to speak. Get that? Like it's a pun, right? Oh, I crack myself up sometimes. Number two, feed according to how the horse's digestive system works. And number three, don't starve your laminitic horse, please. It can make them seriously sick. You can find more information at Carol's website, it's balancedequine.com.au. There's some links on the Horse Sense Show website, on the podcast page, and I'd really like to hear from you. So leave a comment or review on iTunes so that it gets it heard more often, or on the show notes at horsesenseshow.com. And please support the sponsorship of this show by checking out the Equine Care Clinic website at equinecareclinic.com, and we give you information about the latest first response workshops, access to all the products we use at the clinic, and you have access to lots more credible information to keep your horse happy and healthy. Like us on the Equine Care Clinic Facebook page, and you get some great horse tips there too. Thanks also to Angus Strachan for production, and until next time, may your horsing be great horsing, and goodbye.